This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, and before we go any further, as I always do, remind you, check out our Facebook page, Occupied Territory on Facebook. You can just Google Occupied Territory on Facebook, and we've got more and more participation all the time, so join in. Later on in the show, we're going to, not too much later on, in a little while, we're going to have a couple of guests on to discuss something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Trans-Pacific Partnership. You all know NAFTA, I guess, and what NAFTA is, but there's something much larger, even bigger than NAFTA that's developing, which could be 10 times more ruinous than NAFTA has in a while. Basically, we're talking about globalization. So we've got a couple of guests on to explain what this new deal is, which is being done clearly in secret for the obvious reasons, because people would be up in arms about it, maybe even literally, if they knew what was being planned for them all over the world and in the United States. So a couple of guests later, and some other remarks, comments I want to make, some articles I clipped out. Good show coming.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
So I don't know if everybody listening to me is a sports fan, but you don't necessarily have to be to think about or consider the next thing I'm going to talk about. The other night, I'm working hard all day long, writing, mostly reading a lot of books for preparing for radio shows, writing essays, arranging for things, you know, brainy work sort of. And at the end of the day, I just want to relax, right? And I confess it. I watch too much TV, you know. But I turn on things, what I want to watch, sports usually. You know, I'm a sports guy. I'll watch baseball, watch hockey. When there's nothing else to watch, I'll watch football, which is pretty far down my list of things to watch for various reasons. Anyhow, the other night I'm watching football, and I'm aware of the fact. I've been reading a little bit. I see in the sports pages that I'm aware of the fact that there is a lockout of the referees union in the National Football League, professional referees, right? Some of these people have been working there for decades. They are our profession. That's what they do. They're professional football referees. They've been locked out by the owners of these football teams. And so I'm watching the other night, and apparently there's been all kinds of really horrible calls and scandalous arguments. These referees are totally unable to control the players. They don't know the rules. But I don't care that much about football. So I'm looking at TV, and I watch a game between two football teams, Seattle and Green Bay. Green Bay's in Wisconsin. And there was a couple of plays that were really some of the worst calls I've ever seen by referees. Totally ridiculous. But the one that finally was the worst, probably the worst referee call I've ever seen in all of professional sports, the whole time I've been watching sports of any sport, happened at the very end of the game. There was only a couple of seconds left, and one team was losing. So the quarterback of that team just tosses it up, throws it into the end zone, which was a giant crowd there of guys from both teams, right? So his sort of vaguely intended receiver jumps up to catch the ball, which would have tied the game, I think, and or put them 1 point ahead. I think it's tied the game. And there's like 2 seconds left, 1 second, jumps up to catch the ball. A guy from the other team who's covering him intercepts the catch in the end zone in the football game. I'm going to go into the whole rules about football. But he clearly intercepted it. Meanwhile, the other guy's about twice his size, wraps his arms around him, grabs the ball, and brings them both to the ground. A clear interception, game over, Green Bay, you know, the guy who intercepted the ball is on Green Bay, they win. No, no, no. One of the line judges or whatever they are rushes over and sticks his hand straight up in the air, both hands, which means a touchdown, which would mean that the other team wins, Seattle. At the same moment, another line guy comes over, another referee, assistant referee comes over, and rules it not a catch. At the same moment, right? That's bad enough. It was the worst thing I ever saw, right, in terms of refereeing. And it started an entire sort of national outrage debate. I mean, first of all, people have been angry about this since the beginning because all kinds of terrible calls have been made. Games have been lost. People have been hurt. You know, a couple of coaches who basically were so enraged by this kind of amateur behavior jostled some of these people, got fined money. Fans were getting irritated because it wasn't like watching the two teams play as hard as they could and having a level playing field because the referees who they recruited, scabs basically, who they recruited when they locked out the other referees, the union, the referees union, were guys from like high school or junior college. Some of them were actually had jobs like real estate salesmen and were just sort of filling in. They didn't have any idea what the rules are, and they have all these complicated rules about, you know, if you go 2 yards here or if it's the third second or second Tuesday or whatever. They didn't know anything about this. So it was a total farce, and it got even sillier afterwards. And it got to the front pages of the paper. The president starts commenting, and I was sort of interested to see. Now, the referees, I don't know how many there are. So maybe there's 1,000 of them or several hundred of them anyhow. This is several hundred referees maybe, 400, 500. They went on strike. Why? The National Football League takes in $9 billion a year. The owners of the National Football League teams are the one-tenth of the one-tenth of the 1%. You know, these guys are billionaires, or at the poorest of them probably has $500 million, right? They are rich, 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 obscenely, disgustingly rich, right? And you don't even want to know how most of them make their money, like leverage buyouts, you know what I mean, bribing an army to shoot peasants to get oil, whatever it is they do for a living. So these are the guys who own the teams in the National Football League, right? Some of them are legitimate owners. I don't know, legitimate. They inherited from their fathers or whatever. But so they take in $9 billion a year. You could probably guess that they're making somewhere that the owners, after paying the ridiculous salaries they do to the players and paying this person, that person, whatever it is, expenses they have, they probably make tens of millions of dollars per team a year in profit, right? Huge amounts of money. And what was the union asking? The union did not want the owners. The owners were trying to do what they do almost everywhere to everybody. Happened to at my wife's job, right? And that means to us, both of us. The unions, the owners wanted to phase out pensions. All these guys want to phase out pensions. Now, it's one thing to try to understand that governments, for various reasons, can't afford government pensions, that kind of thing, right? Whatever. What they call entitlements. The real entitlements are the rich. They're the ones who are entitled and act like they're entitled. But in private corporations, like huge corporations that make millions, billions in profit, they're still trying to phase out pensions. They don't have enough billions of dollars. They're that greedy. So basically what they do is, in this area, they wanted to phase out the pensions for the referees and substitute 401ks. And anybody who's ever been involved in that, as little as I understand economics, knows that that is a bad deal, right? Because what's happening is that, the people who, you know, who are getting these pensions are going to fare less well than with the 401k. And so the referees demanded that they keep their pensions, right? Now, what was the total amount? Here's the total amount of money that it would have cost. There was one or two other things the owners wanted, but that was the main thing, right? The total amount of money that it would have cost the National Football League owners to give to the whole union if they just allowed the pensions to remain was $3.2 million. That is the amount of money that any one of these owners has in his back pocket any day of the week to spend on, whatever it is, cars or ice cream. $3.2 million, chump change to these billionaires. They didn't want to give it to them. It's unbelievable, right? So this is what you get. You get this outrageous play, and even the president got involved, which made me even more bitter about him, right? When all the public employees were striking in Wisconsin, did he show up in Wisconsin and support working people in the union? He never heard of the place. He wouldn't set foot in Wisconsin. Lazy son of a bitch that he is, right? Cowardly, cautious son of a bitch. When the teachers were striking in Chicago just recently, he didn't say one word about that. No, because his best friend and associate, Mr. Emanuel, who runs the place in Chicago, used to be his chief of staff, he has tens of millions of dollars, and he knows friends who have tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. So who did he choose? He chose the rich mayor and the political boss of Chicago and his rich friends over the teachers and basically the students of Chicago. That's our president, right? But What's the first time that he gets involved in a labor dispute? The other day, because he's a football fan, he says, that's a terrible call. I hope the union comes back. I hope the real refs come back soon. Now he supports the union. And that's only because, by the way, that there's been a national outcry. You're talking about 90% of people who vote and also watch sports were outraged. So he could afford to be outraged. Unbelievable. $3.2 million they wanted, which is, believe me, what one of these owners makes in maybe a week. And they went, and that's the total that the union wanted. Anyhow, people got so crazy and outraged about it. And this is America, right? Because their entertainment was being interfered with, you know, and their sports team. Forget about teachers, students, people starving, cops, fire protection. Well, who cares? But they couldn't watch football because the they didn't have good referees. That's really hurting America. Unbelievable. So finally, we got the news this morning that the lockout is over, that the billionaires, these bastards, bowed under the pressure of their fans. And basically, it's a bottom line problem. People were getting so sick of it. They were, you know, thinking about, they were afraid they weren't going to tune in. Commercials wouldn't have been able to sell for as much, whatever. People wouldn't buy their paraphernalia, you know, like a $100 wristband, whatever it is. It says Ravens on it. Meanwhile, unbelievable. And this goes on all over the place. Verizon, this gigantic company that makes billions of dollars in profit every year and pays almost no taxes. In fact, I think a couple of years they didn't pay any taxes at all. Was locking out there, was refusing to negotiate with their union and finally settle with their union to give them some chump change that the union was asking for. On and on and on and on. They have the government in their pocket. They have the power. They just stamp all over people. I mean, this is why unions are so important. And this whole, and even Scott Walker, this rat, the governor of Wisconsin, this slimy rat who tried to get rid of unions, which is he was the head of, like, you know, kill the union movement in the United States, the symbol of it, who works directly for the Koch brothers. Not an exaggeration. He basically is an employee of the Koch brothers, right? Who tries to squash public unions there and rouse people, you know, with pitchforks, you know, the lazy teachers, the lazy cops, the lazy firemen. Oh, man. Unbelievable. Scott Walker even has to, because of the public outrage, it's Green Bay, Wisconsin, and he's the governor of Wisconsin. He has to come in and say, I hope the union comes back. Oh, now he likes unions. What a sick, crazy, greedy, terminal country this is. I mean, is there any way that we can reverse our culture and our morals and our principles in this country? I really don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I saw this call and I was outraged. But to me, it's, you know, I mean, basically, generally speaking, like, for instance, the hockey players are locked out this year. But there's no National Hockey League season this year, which, if you're a hockey fan like I am, is disappointing. But so what? If I don't watch sports on TV, if I don't even look at TV, it's not real life. It's just entertainment, right? But when this is what goes on. This is typically American, too. The owners of the National Hockey League and the league itself sort of got together and locked out the players because the players wanted too much money. This is basically an argument between people who have hundreds of millions of dollars and people who make millions or tens of millions of dollars. Hockey players, the average hockey player's salary is like $850,000. Talk about an 18-year-old kid who can hardly spell, graduates from high school, that's what they make, right, for hitting a piece of rubber with a stick. Others are getting paid $6, $7, $8, $10 million a year. And they're arguing with the owners who, some of them lose money on these teams, but it doesn't matter because they own, you know, half of the United States forest, the wood in the United States, or all the oil in the United States. It doesn't bother them. They're not going begging, believe me. But so generally when these lockouts happen, it's an argument between billionaires and millionaires. This one was outrageous. The total amount that all of the referees wanted added up to $3.2 million. And the president finally says something about it. Where was he during the Chicago teacher strike? Where was he during the uprising at Madison, Wisconsin, when regular people in unions who work hard every day at their jobs that save people's lives and teach people when they are upset? This guy is such a slimy jellyfish. He really gets to me. Anyhow, let us move on to something where I hope we can get some sort of more substantial. Maybe this is the way to fix things. You know, just outright. This is called Occupied Territory, this show, and it's about alternatives to the regular political structure. and the regular corporate structure and the regular way of doing things and getting things done in the country, i.e. civil disobedience and everything else like that. We're going to have our guests on. As soon as my engineer tells me that we got our guests on the phone, I guess he's trying to get them now, we will have an interview with them. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, I wish I knew more about economics because everything's about economics, right? But it's the big hole in, I mean, there's a lot of things I don't know about, but if there's one thing I know less about than anything else, it's economics. I mean, from even balancing a checkbook or adding two and two to, God knows, understanding international trade agreements or debt or collateralized mortgage instrument, whatever these things are, stocks, bonds, loans, banks. But sometimes I feel like, and I don't want to sound like some kind of naive idiot, but sometimes it does seem to me, like, for instance, you're having these giant strikes, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, literally in Spain, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people surrounding the parliament building, marching in the streets, yelling, fighting with the cops, demanding that they don't get actually starved to death. In Spain, there are thousands of people. There are thousands of people in Spain who are going through garbage dumps every single night just to be able to get, you know, rancid food to feed themselves. Forget about, you know, recession. That's a polite word. We're actually entering a world depression. It may get very worse, a lot faster, too, than people thought. And it could be like the 30s. And yet, over the last, I don't know, whatever it is, 10 or 20 years, the only segment of the American population, just to pick America, that has gotten richer by a huge factor is the top 1% of the country. They have gotten 13% richer. This is figures announced recently, some study or poll. The middle class and the lower middle class are getting less money now than they ever did. Prices have gone up, but they get less money than they ever. They earn less money. They have fewer resources. And the rich are getting richer. This is America. Over there, when this happens, hundreds of thousands of people turn out and strike and become enraged and circle the parliament building. Over here, we get a total of like 5,000 people across the entire country in various cities, occupying parks and then disappearing after a while. I mean, yeah, sure, the cops attacked them. But, you know, I mean, what is wrong with America? I don't know. Meanwhile, part of the job of this show is to reveal this information and to discuss what's really going on. And we have our guest today, Laurel Sutherland, who is Rainforest Action Network's communications manager for the Forest Program. And we have Arthur Stamoulis, if I'm saying that right, executive director of Citizens Trade Campaign. You both there?
Yes. Good morning, Mike.
Oh, hiya. So I was trying to explain before, but I can't. That's why you're on. What the Trans-Pacific, recently there was a demonstration that, of course, never got covered in the mainstream media, against this place, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They were having a secret meeting, literally, guarded by, you know, whoever, the cops or hired guards. What city was it in where the meeting was?
Leesburg,
Virginia, the golf resort, totally inaccessible to the public.
And who am I just hearing from here? I don't have Skype, so. Was that Laurel or Arthur?
This is Laurel Sutherland.
Okay. This secret meeting was to almost, I guess, finalize, and you can tell me more about it, or it's one of the last meetings in the finalization of a deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And maybe either Arthur or Laurel could explain to me what that, obviously the demonstration was met with the usual, you know, some people like my hero, Margaret Flowers, tried to break into it or, you know, demonstrate, and she probably got arrested. But it was a few hundred people turned out or several hundred people, but essentially, this is a secret thing, which, of course, most people in the media don't want to talk about because corporations own them. So what is the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Yeah, this is Arthur. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an international trade and investment pact being negotiated between the United States and 10 other countries throughout the Pacific Rim. It would be the largest free trade agreement in U.S. history. And at its core, it does two things. One, it makes it easier for big corporations to continue shipping jobs around the world to wherever labor is the most exploited and environmental regulations are the weakest. Companies like Walmart not only think that American workers are overpaid, but they think that Chinese sweatshop workers are overpaid, and they want access to even cheaper labor pools in countries like Vietnam, where workers are paid a third to a half of what workers in China are paid. And then the other part of it is really handcuffing government's ability to regulate in the public interest. So the TPP is said to have some 29 separate chapters. There's a chapter, you know, on restricting banking regulations. There's a chapter on restricting food safety regulations. There's a chapter on restricting government procurement policy. There's all sorts of chapters that would limit environmental regulations.
I understand that also the United States, that there's some difference between the two, between the various corporations, and I would say governments, but actually the governments that work for the corporations. There's some difference between them, some arguments. And, for instance, the United States, it says here in this article I'm reading, is advocating greater corporate power, and nations that oppose extending patents, this is who's arguing, and listen to this, extending patents to artificially increase the cost of drugs, the lack of regulation of big finance, copyright laws, the United States, copyright laws that extend for protection for 120 years, et cetera, et cetera. So the United States, is, are they being on the right wing of this? Are they the hardliners in the midst of this whole group?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, each of the negotiating negotiators tend to represent the upper echelons and the 1% of their society, but the U.S. far and away is pushing the most radical pro-corporate, anti-worker, anti-environment provisions in the TPP. And, you know, one of the chapters that was leaked shows the U.S. exactly pushing for extension of drug patents beyond their current 20 years so that people will be forced to pay, you know, monopoly drug prices, which would jack up healthcare costs here in the U.S. and be a death sentence for people with HIV, tuberculosis, other treatable diseases in developing countries.
So let me ask you a little bit about the background of this. When was it first proposed and developed? Did this go back to the Bush administration?
Yeah, this goes back to the Bush administration, and when the Obama administration came in, they took, you know, a small hiatus, you know, got all the other countries involved to take a break for about a year, but they've been negotiating in earnest now for 3 years, and the Leesburg round that just wrapped up in Virginia was the 14th major round of negotiations. So
how close are we getting to what they would consider a final agreement?
There'll certainly be a few more rounds before they're done, but, you know, again, after 3 years, they're certainly, you know, within 6 to 12 months of finishing this thing, if we let them. Obviously, you know, we're fighting to prevent that.
Well, now, let me ask you a couple of questions about it. Now, I read an article, maybe you know about this article, and I forget who wrote it, but somebody who, I think he even wrote a book about all this, but an article that said that this was developed during the Bush administration, but then a lot of countries and a lot of corporations, especially, because that's really what we're talking about, got very angry at the Bush administration because of the invasions in Iraq and other places. In other words, that the Bush administration was basically bad for business, that is to say international business. And they had to wait till Obama came in, Mr. Hope and Change, before they could actually be friendly again and get together and unite to screw everybody in the world, right?
Yeah, and then Mark Engler wrote a book called How to Rule the World, you know, about sort of that difference between the hard power military, you know, imperialism mm-hmm. versus the neoliberal imperialism of, you know, creating these economic rules that force countries into line. You know, I mean, obviously they play upon each other. But, yeah, no, a lot of Wall Street, you know, a lot of big corporations have been very happy with the TPP and the direction it's heading in. You know, are behind it, yeah.
Let me ask you this: What benefits would a politician like Obama come and say to the American people that they were going to get from this? How could he possibly sell a thing like this? How do you figure he's going to try to sell this? Or is he going to bother at all?
Yeah, the thing they've been saying for 20 years now, you know, Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, the first Bush, is that we need to export more products. And that, you know, if we reduce these tariffs and these barriers to trade, we're going to export more and sell more to the rest of the world, and that's going to create jobs here in the United States. They never look at balance of trade. They never look at the fact that our trade deficit has exploded under NAFTA-style trade agreements. They never look at all the other goodies for corporations that are in here. And, you know, I mean, the 20-year track record is obvious. These have been massive job killers for the United States. We've lost about 3.5 million jobs directly mm-hmm. under NAFTA-style trade agreements since NAFTA was first enacted in the mid-90s. And this agreement would hugely expand that record. And there's, you know, there's, you know, maybe 20 years ago, someone might have an excuse for buying into that, but no longer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that, you know, that's just extraordinary about this is that in order to have to answer those kind of questions, somebody has to be asking them. And, you know, even though, as Arthur mentioned, this has been going on, these discussions, for 3 years, and we're in the 14th round of negotiations that just ended, there has been an almost complete veil of secrecy surrounding these talks, to the point where, you know, not only has the public not been allowed in, but even the, you know, the media hasn't been allowed in, but even high-ranking members of Congress have been denied access. So while you've got, you know, hundreds of corporate lobbyists at the table, you know, you've got nobody representing the people, and then nobody asking the meaningful questions. And that really is the one thing that hopefully, you know, we as a people movement can have some control over, is really breaking into that veil of secrecy and getting the word out and really sort of reigniting the anti-globalization movement that really did wield significant power not so many years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this question. I mean, you've got officials of all the governments in the country, especially governments with a lot of corporate power and a lot of you know, money power. You've got officials of governments meeting. I guess, you know, do you know some of the names of these people? But you're talking about secretaries of commerce, that kind of people, right, who are meeting from various countries. And then you've got high-ranking members of corporations meeting with them, which is already probably illegal according to some various American laws, which are ignored all the time. You have no representative of our elected officials in Congress meeting there. You've got corporations and members of various governments and administrations meeting together in secret. Do these? I don't know about other governments, and I suspect in some democracies they will have to go back to representative bodies and get this approved. Does Obama, once this treaty is agreed to, he can't just put his name on it and that's it? Doesn't he still have to go to Congress to get an approval for this?
That's right. So, you know, once the negotiations are over, they're signed, the deal is done, no significant changes can be made, then the president has to bring it to Congress. And they've already said that the only way this can pass is under what's called fast track. Trade Promotion Authority,
mm-hmm.
So the process by which ordinary amendment, review, debate procedures are cut off. There's no filibuster. They only need a simple majority, and Congress is presented with a thumbs up or thumbs down, yes or no vote. And, Congress is a very, very difficult place to get the majority to stand up and say no to big corporate interests.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically because most of them are running on money donated by rich people or corporate interests or PACs. And in fact, I think the last thing I read was approximately half the members of Congress are millionaires or multimillionaires, correct?
Yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm trying to maintain the illusion, because it's good for my sanity that we live in some semblance of a representative democracy. But this kind of thing with a Trans-Pacific Partnership is... I keep talking about last nails in the coffin. There's been about 50 of them. There's a lot of nails in this coffin, right? So, but
yeah, it really does read like a, you know, they call it a free trade agreement, but it really does read like a wish list of the, you know, transnational corporate elite. It's just, you know, as bad as we've seen with NAFTA and the World Trade Organization in years past, this is just really a shift in the balance of power, you know, away from nation states and toward corporations that may be bigger than anything than we've ever seen. It really is absolutely frightening and outrageous.
Well, so then, you know, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, I mean, the one hopeful thing I'll say is, because it's so big, because it's so ambitious, because there are so many countries involved, there is a opportunity for this thing to collapse under its own weight. If the word gets out, if people, you know, start acting on it. And we saw it, you know, we saw it in 1999 in Seattle, where people said, you know, enough with the World Trade Organization, the WTO. People protested in the streets. Developing countries felt like, you know, maybe it was okay to say no to the United States. And you know, for 13 years, they've been trying to revive the WTO's expansionary agenda and have failed. You know, we saw it with the Free Trade Area of the Americas. People might remember, you know, the march to Miami and the big protest there. You know, and that collapsed under its own weight. And, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade deal for the, you know, essentially the entire Pacific Rim, you know, is hugely ambitious. There are people fighting it, you know, all throughout the world. You know,
are there really? I mean, for instance, what kind of groups are we talking about?
Well, I mean, here in the United States, you've got labor, environmental, family farm, consumer, internet freedom groups starting to speak out. You know, in Japan, one of the countries that's considering entering, 12 million people have already signed a petition, you know, opposing entry into the TPP.
If 12 million people, if 12 million people in Japan are doing that, that must mean that some media, some major media, is discussing it, right?
Yeah, no, in a lot of countries, this is front page news. Not in the United States, but in a lot of countries, yes.
Really? That's really something. So, Laurel, what about, are there websites and places people can go? What is like a single website? What's the best single website? Or give me two websites that people who are listening can go to get involved in organizing, signing petitions, whatever.
Well, certainly the Citizens Trade Campaign's website is a really good one. You know, there have been only two chapters that have been leaked to allow us a degree of insight into what's been happening, and they've got the best analysis and access that I've seen.
And so say it again so people can know.
Arthur, what is the site?
The URL is citizenstrade.org.
Citizenstrade.org.
Plural trade.org, yeah.
And citizenstrade.org is, how is that organized? Who are we talking about there?
Yeah, so I work for Citizens Trade Campaign, and it's a national coalition of labor, family farm, environmental consumer, other social justice organizations, you know, that work together to try to stop the expansion of these NAFTA-style trade pacts.
Now, obviously, this all sort of dovetails with everything else that's going on. I mean, when the president, you know, finally signs a law that gives him the right, which he's already using in some ways, to declare anybody a terrorist, you know, and then to be locked up without, you know, any habeas corpus and without any trial, probably. I mean, temporarily, at least, Chris Hedges and a bunch of other people sued on one of the clauses in the National Defense Authorization Act, where the president had the right to actually sort of declare anyone a terrorist. What we've seen with the Occupy movement and what we've seen with protests at the last two conventions, the recent conventions, and what we've seen in protests in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years, is that people in charge in the government, and certainly they're hand in hand with corporations and other places like the Goldman Sachs or whatever, they have decided and managed to start to convince the public, because they own the media, that to protest the government of the United States or corporations is to be a terrorist, right? You guys there?
I mean, it certainly seems like they're looking to move in that direction. You know, I think that one of the things that is hopeful about, you know, that Arthur started to mention about the movement resisting this free trade agreement is that it is rapidly growing, and it's so broad-based that you know, it would be very hard to marginalize or categorize the resistance to a movement like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because, you know, you've got the Occupy movement there, but then you've also got organized labor, you've got the biggest environmental organizations, you know, in the country, you've got people concerned about, you know, pediatricians and families, you know, concerned about medical prices, you've got, you know, technology people concerned about internet freedom. It's so broad-based.
So places like freepress.org and have you gotten places like MoveOn involved yet?
Yeah, there's actually a petition out by Avaaz, which is sort of the international move on right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that itself has, you know, I mean, just from the Leesburg round about a week ago, over 700,000 signatures on it. So, yeah, groups like that are certainly involved.
So all of these things really do link up very clearly. It's not too hard to see the connections now. When you've got these protests in Spain and Greece where millions of people, hundreds of thousands, if not actually millions of people, are turning out enraged by what's going on. I was saying earlier before you came on that I wish I knew more about economics, but sometimes maybe you sort of don't if you know a little bit about human nature and the way things work simply between people. Apparently, or what looks very clear to me is, when you can see it with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is that you know, a few corporations, or let's say 100 major international corporations, and let's say maybe a couple of dozen banks, sort of own and run the world. And why is that absolutely necessary? Why is it that banks, international banks, or Germany, or whatever trade organization, International Monetary Fund, can take populations of Greece and Spain, adding up to, what, 100 million people or something like that, and make them all poor? Now, how does that work?
Well, it works in terms that our elected officials, you know, are representing the tops, the elites of each society, and not the majority. I mean, you know, there's this big sort of push out there that, you know, you need to be an economist, you need to have a PhD to be able to understand international trade policy, you know, and that's not the case. Mm-hmm. Look at where the jobs in your community have gone. Look at whether people, you know, if their income levels are going up or staying stagnant. Look at what's happening to our environment and consumer safety. And it's clear, it's obvious that, you know, these policies are not put in place for ordinary working people. You know, and I think there was a time, you know, maybe a couple decades ago where people would say, well, you know, which country do these agreements benefit and which country does it hurt? You know, right. Is it good for the United States? Is it good for China? Who's it good for? No, it's good for the top of each country, and it's bad for the majority of each country. You know, and that's why they're negotiating, and that's who's negotiating these pacts, and that's what they're all about.
You know, it's interesting when you see that, you know, this whole sort of right-wing fundamentalist kind of ignorant anti-United Nations movement. You know, they're always afraid that the United Nations is going to take over the United States. And in fact, what they don't know is that actually there is a kind of United Nations of corporations and puppet governments that are, in fact, taking over the world. So while they're marching around, you know, protesting the UN, that's not really where the threat is.
Well, and that's exactly right. And that's one of the, you know, unusual points of unity that could happen between the right and left here is that, you know, the degree of sovereignty that's given up on the part of nation states under an agreement like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm. you know, it really sets up, you know, a parallel system of governance and a parallel system of justice that allows corporations to go into, you know, a tribunal of corporate trade lawyers and sue nation states to potentially overturn democratically elected laws. Mm-hmm. And that, it's, you know, it sounds very much like a conspiracy that the right wing would be, you know, outraged about, except it's actually real and happening. And, you know, I would certainly hope that we would see the awakening of the right wing on this, which is something I never thought I'd hear myself say.
But now here we have something that basically we're talking about age-old concepts. I mean, you know, whenever it was Marx and Engels are writing, is it 1850s or 60s, workers of the world unite. I also would like to see a worldwide unity, but not of corporations and not of some imaginary UN police force, but of basically, and it is somewhat encouraging when you read the papers, and maybe you two can tell me what you think. I'm seeing strikes in China, you know what I mean, of all places, huge, like angry, violent even strikes in China. I'm seeing, you know, turnouts in Russia where people are destined to wind up in jail, if not worse, but they still turn out in tens of thousands. All over the world, people are finally sort of getting it together. Workers are getting it together to come out and oppose dictatorial governments, and here we have something which is approaching that now with Homeland Security and all. But still there has never been, and I don't know, could there ever be a united world organization of workers? This is some sort of idealistic thing. It could never happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not an area where I have a lot of expertise, but there's the International Trade Union Confederation, other groups. And, you know, and the thing I'll say around the TPP is that organizations, labor groups, environmental groups, others are working very much hand-in-hand across borders. And so, you know, it's one of these areas where when corporations and global elites, you know, overreach too much, you know, people do react. And so, you know, we're working with groups in New Zealand and Australia and Chile and Peru, you know, and Canada and Mexico, you know, and, you know, less so in Brunei and Vietnam, although there are some connections there, Malaysia. You know, and people are uniting and fighting back. And, you know, obviously we have a long way to go before we're at that point where we're, you know, we're as strong and we're as organized as, you know, capital is.
What happens is when you get these uprisings, these righteous uprisings against this imposition of, you know, of globalization by corporations and then, you know, shutdowns by government, you know, like throwing out protections of privacy, protections of protest, laws against this and that. Even in Vietnam, I just read in the paper the other day, they're increasing the severity of laws against protesting the government. So in other words, literally we're talking about reactionaries. They are reacting to this anger, right, by even getting tougher, which is usually what happens. Last question would be, and this sort of concerns Occupy too, how And I've read enough history. How could you ever possibly, people from the lower middle class and the middle class or working class, how could they possibly ever change anything without an actual violent revolution?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's we saw the seeds of one answer to that when, you know, the day that January 1st, 1994, that the Zapatistas had their uprising in Mexico was not a coincidence, but that was the day that the NAFTA went into effect. And, you know, there was an awakening of solidarity across Europe and then in the United States of people, you know, taking their cue and learning, you know, a new level of international coordination and sophistication coming from a most unlikely source at that point, you know, indigenous folks in southern Mexico.
So what was the end result of that?
Well, I, you know, one of the end results was what we saw in Seattle and the, you know, the major uprising where you had, you know, a U.S. president flying into a major U.S. city under martial law, because, you know, because so many different, kinds of people had come together to, in a show of people power that really did shut down the plans of the international elite at that time. And, you know, and because of 9/11 and many other reasons, you know, that movement, you know, faltered. And then I think the TPP shows us that they have really adapted to our tactics, and we have not yet, you know, readapted to theirs. But there is, I think, hope that when people across the world, and we have an increasingly interconnected world where people understand that the governments are not representative of the people that, you know, in those countries, mm-hmm. You know, it's very exciting, and that is certainly at play and growing today, but I would hope to see it grow much larger.
I would love to see somebody, I mean, lately I've been reading in the papers the last couple of days, now that the presidential debate is going to be next Wednesday, I think, that everybody is like, I see petitions demanding that Jim Lehrer do this and demanding that Jim Lehrer ask that. You know what I mean? Like, ask about Citizens United. I'd love to hear a question to these two candidates about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because they're both, I'm sure that Romney thinks it's a wonderful idea, and I'm sure that Obama would really be put on the spot. I don't know how he'd wriggle out of it. It's too bad, you know, because on some of these other debates, you know, they had people email things, and I don't know how much they filter it, but it would be great. I would love to be the you know, the moderator of one of these debates. I'd like to ask some real questions, right? Don't you feel that sometimes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I your point is right. Both, unfortunately, Romney and Obama have, you know, virtually the same position on this. I'm sure they'd do their spin. But it would be good for there to be some accountability that way.
Well, I don't think we're going to get it from Jim Lehrer. It's just not going to happen. But it would be a breath of fresh air to ask him a really hard question. But they have learned their lesson. They don't meet in any major cities anymore. They meet on some island or in some out-of-the-way place which is surrounded by, you know, 2,000 yards of woods, barbed wire, and hired guards. And they learned that, you know. It's, and then the media, you know, geez, they really let you down. I mean, is there any hope in reclaiming? It always amazes me, you know, studying this somewhat, being involved in radio for so long, that the Federal Communications Commission essentially grants these licenses to these giant media companies that inform still like 70% of the people, you know, aside from the Internet. And these licenses are supposed to be granted by the people of the United States. You know, and yet you never hear about this kind of thing, which directly affects every one of us.
No, I mean, obviously, I think everyone knows the major failings of the corporate media in this country. I mean, hopefully we'll get to a point where, you know, Pacifica can host a debate and the candidates show up. But, yeah, I mean, you know, that's part of what the TPP is about. It's about, you know, doing the same sort of media consolidation that's happened in this country globally. And, you know, and Internet freedom groups are speaking out, you know, in big, big ways about how the intellectual property provisions of this agreement could limit Internet freedom, could, you know, force, you know, companies like Google, which own YouTube, to crack down, you know, on all sorts of, you know, people's bottom-up media. I mean, you know, that's sort of, you know, I mean, people talk about it a lot, you know, where one of the hopes are for communications is, you know, oh, you have this Internet where people can talk to one another directly.
Right, right.
And I don't think that's going to change completely, but certainly, you know, if you make it harder for people to post videos on YouTube and more expensive,
I think
that's a huge barrier.
Well, obviously, yeah, you're right about that. And obviously the Internet would be probably the major tool in uniting people all over the world. In fact, it is clearly the major tool in uniting people all over the world. If that gets clamped down on, forget about it, then people will be in the dark and they won't be able to unite. So that's probably the main place. But here's a chance where you might hope for some real success, because the last couple of times anybody tried to clamp down like that, they got, at least in this country, they got really swamped by people. And, you know, a huge number of people just shut them down when they wanted to do that, you know. So.
No, that's right. And you see these very strange alliances in Congress around that issue, specific to the TPP, where, you know, Congressman, you know, Daryl Issa, Senator Ron Wyden, you know, from different political parties, both of whom have been, you know, longtime supporters of free trade agreements, mm-hmm. speaking out vehemently about this section of the TPP.
Well, once again, you know, we have been talking to Arthur Stamoulis and Laurel Sutherland, and maybe you could each give the website of your organization so people at least know where they can sort of gather or participate in something. Laurel, why don't you go first?
Thank you. Well, I'm with the Rainforest Action Network, and we are at ran.org.
Okay. And Arthur?
I'm with Citizens Trade Campaign, and our website is citizenstrade.org.
Okay, listen, thanks for coming on, and I'll try to, I have a show on Sirius XM. I'll try to book you guys on there, too, and we'll spread it as far as we can.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Okay, let's take a little break here, and then we'll come back, and I have a few closing comments. All right. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We're here every Thursday at 2 p.m. And once again, I urge you to join in this movement. That's a good word for it. It's a movement. You know, obviously, it is it's a collective gathering. It's a movement. And it is clearly happening all over the world. It's really amazing to see. And it's inevitable, I suppose, the way the world works. But internationalism and globalism and, you know, the altruistic ideologies of people, you know, as workers of the world unite. One day we'll all be brothers and sisters together, and we'll all be, you know, marching to freedom and prosperity for all people. Well, yeah, I know. Meanwhile, the bad guys, who basically own and run the earth, get stronger and stronger and stronger, and yet there are constant reactions. I've never seen it so clear in my existence, and I guess with all the reading I've done, at least of history, and once again, I'm not, you know, I'm sadly misinformed or uninformed on economics, but of all the historical reading I've done, and I've done a whole lot, international and American history, I have never seen it clearly so set out that things are expanding internationally. Something like the, you know, with jet travel, the internet, especially more than anything else, with high-speed travel, you know, with more available ways to get different places. The euro was something that doesn't look like it's working out too well. But little by little by little, there are technological ways and there are attitudes of people on the earth that there is just one world we live in. And then when you see this concern about global warming, everybody in the world except for people who are very rich and insane and don't care if they poison the earth and take everybody with them, including themselves, and people who are fundamentalist religious people who believe that there's another world, so who cares if this one falls apart or blows up? And so they have the luxury, since they're going to heaven and the rest of us are going to hell, and they're going to fly around on their little wings or whatever, or eat grapes or whatever religion it is, that there is no science, there is no global warming. So as the world is being destroyed by corporations and actually by the populations of countries, as I was talking about football early in the show, you know, they show you this. It's hard to watch these things. And I know I shouldn't watch TV. I know. But, I'm looking. I just want to try to relax. I've been reading all day long. My eyes are blurry. It's easier to stare at the color TV. But I look at it, and they do these long shots when they come back from commercials of the football stadiums. The amount of lights. This is a night game, right? The amount of light and power that's involved. The amount of burning of fossil fuels to light up one stupid football game. What I care, I like watching TV. I like to watch sports. If suddenly no TV worked, if every television in the world shut down, would we lose anything? Would anything be lost? Now, of course, there are probably, in the aggregate, hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple of million jobs associated with TV. Maybe there's tens of millions of jobs. In other words, it's a vast, complicated switching that would have to go on. But will we lose anything? Look at all. What if every sports team that played at night was forbidden to play at night? Think of the trillions of dollars all over the world that would be saved in the course of a couple of years in just power output alone. The world is getting smaller all the time. And the question is, the big question, which will determine all of our futures and the human race's future, is will we allow people, as it's getting smaller, to treat us all like slaves and serfs, tell us what to do, and poison the earth? Will that happen? Will that happen? And will they basically form international corporate armies, which they're sort of doing now? There's not much of a division between international sovereign armies like the United States and corporate power. In fact, in some places, the line has been very clearly crossed. Chevron in Nigeria hired or, subcontracted the Nigerian army to go into places and murder dozens, sometimes some say hundreds of people who were protesting oil drilling on certain lands that was destroying people's fisheries, destroying coasts, destroying woodlands. They hired the army. This has happened in India, too, that a major corporation, I forget which one, hired portions of the Indian army in India to go in and deal with a union that was threatening to, destroy some corporate's profit center in India. All over the world, this combination of corporations. Now, when this happens in individual countries, it's basically fascism. What brought Hitler to power was a combination of his insane fundamentalist violence, growing out of a depression, and, redneck ignorance, and major corporations who funded him, who backed him. Same thing in Italy with Mussolini. Fascism, the dictatorship of the state, military power, and corporations all combined. And it's always a Frankenstein monster. The corporations thought that when they backed Hitler and that he would work for them. Turned out he was so insane and had access to so much violence, and the fundamentalist violence got out of control, and even the corporations were all brought down because Germany was destroyed and so were the corporations. Although they rebounded pretty well. Places like Krupp, Mercedes, Bayer, international chemical companies, they do okay. Somehow they made it back to the world. But so this kind of corporate fascism and international cooperation of the forces of actual repression, that is to say, armies, navies, air forces, spying on citizens, all of this is being concentrated. There is real cooperation in the world among the people that own and run the world, not to the majority's benefit. There's about 95% of the people in the world who are suffering because of the few people who are greedy psychopaths that own and run these governments and its corporations, hand in hand. What's encouraging, although who knows whether when it comes down to the showdown, as it's happening more and more all the time, it's encouraging to see that there are strikes in China, there are uprisings in various other countries, there are demonstrations of hundreds of thousands, even millions of people in various European countries. And occasionally when that happens in a democracy, the governments will back off and not lower these austerity plans on people and actually literally wind up killing tens of thousands of people, starving them to death, no medical care, all that kind of stuff. Now, what's got to happen is that people all over the world have to feel like there's some unity. It's not the United Nations. It's not some pie-in-the-sky ideology and sitting around campfires singing, unity songs. I don't know what it's going to be. Maybe there will be one large international organization or combination of organizations which is coordinated. this lateralism and no hierarchy of Occupy is a dead end. Maybe this kind of thing will be coordinated in some way or led in some way. And it's going to be a fight to the death. These greedy psychopaths who own and run the world with their armies, with their spying, NSA here and everywhere else in the world, with their stamping out of protests, with their treating workers like slaves, with their beating and torturing. Sooner or later, there's billions more of us than there are of them. And sooner or later, it's going to come down to a showdown. It's already happening. And I can't believe when I read that there are violent strikes in China against the government and all that, and turnouts in Russia, of all places. In this country, we are the ones who lag behind. Workers here, people here are the laziest, the most hypnotized by media, and the most clueless of all the people in the world. Clearly, that's happening. So we only have to hope, and we just got to keep trying and trying and trying and not let them get away with this stuff.